Welcome to the Country Squire podcast, Red Trousers. My name is Dominic Whiteman, and I am here with
Jamie Foster.
The format of this, our ninth Red Trousers podcast, is as simple as gluing letters to a conference stage wall. We split the half-hour podcast into three 10-minute sections and deal with three separate subjects. To decide on the subjects, we have a bucket in front of us of Country Squire readers' questions. Balls of scrunched up paper, which will be randomly picked out of the bucket by Jamie's butler, Basil. Jamie and I will then address the question until after 10 minutes have passed. We will hear this awful sound and we will shut up and move on to the next question. So, without further ado, Basil, will you please ask Jamie the first question? Thank you, Basil.
So the first question is from John Hewson. The Tories are on the verge of a nervous breakdown and need to man up, warns Scottish leader Ruth Davison. Is she right? Well, Dom, what do you think?
Well, this was the speech by Ruth Davison at the beginning of the Tory conference at the start of this week. And that was before Speechgate and the ensuing faux pas by Boris Johnson and Rebecca Powell. Do you hear what Rebecca Powell said?
Yes, something about the inner cities not having any soil.
Exactly. So there were plenty of fodder for Labour to feed on. She was probably right, and she is probably right. The Tories still worse state now, I think, than they were at the beginning of the week, and they are on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Do they need to man up? Well, put it this way, I think everyone is talking about May being replaced, and I don't see a female candidate amidst those potential candidates who could possibly be Prime Minister. So in the sense of mailing up, yes, I think she's absolutely right. But again, this talk of manning up and nervous breakdowns, Piers Morgan got in awful trouble for talking about this a couple of months ago. I don't think it's probably that appropriate, implying that mental illness makes you incompetent. Is she saying that in order to sort of get over mental health issues? We all need to simply man up. Is she sort of suggesting that someone having a nervous breakdown is unfit to continue with their job? Or is she just using standard parlance to say the Tories are in a parlous state?
I think probably the latter. And as you say, she's probably right. It's interesting, isn't it, that the Tories are now searching around for where they position themselves. May's speech, which was effectively upstaged by Simon Brodkin's silly prank. And her own coughing fit, if it hadn't been, would have been analysed as being Ed Miliband-esque, wouldn't it?
It would. I mean, in normal circumstances, you know, should be gone, I think. I think it's because we've got Brexit negotiations underway. Secondly, Tory MPs don't agree on who a successor to May could be. And third, I think many Tories are terrified of a general election just in case, you know, the dreadful Corbyn gets in through the back door. I think in normal circumstances, she'd be gone.
And where do they position themselves, whether she's there or not? Is it more as a centrist party? Do they move to the right? Do they move to the left? What is the place for the Tories at the moment? Because they don't seem to have established any real position under her, any real philosophy.
I think that's an easy one. I think that the message should be simple. Right-wing politics will safeguard classical liberal values, and they just need to ditch this kind of victimhood, fetishizing identity politics that the Corbyn left thrives upon.
But that's not what they appear to be doing, is it?
Not at all. I mean, but how can a party adopt any position when it's rudderless? Without a strong leader, you are a rudderless party.
Yeah.
And that's the, you know, the nub of the issue is May, is it not?
And Mrs. May seems to be a very unlucky politician. Everything she touches seems to turn to the opposite of gold. Not just the letters falling off the stage behind her, not just being targeted by a prankster, not just having a terrible coughing fit, But every time the general election, every time she puts her name to anything, it seems to come unstuck, doesn't it?
I remember having a coffee the day after the 2015 election with a senior, I mean, he's a former chief exec of the Conservative Party, and he sat there in shock that Cameron had won a majority. And he smiled and said, you know, in Conservative Central Office, David Cameron is the rainmaker.
Yeah.
He brings luck to our party. And the longer we can keep him, the better. So that was 2015, summer of 2015. And look what's happened since.
Yeah.
So luck, I mean, as Gary Player said, you make your own luck, don't you? Has Theresa May been badly advised? Is she just the wrong person for the job?
I think she may well be the wrong person for the job.
I agree. I don't think it's a question of being advised. If you're strong enough as a leader, you need little advice.
Or at least you know how to take the advice that you're given.
Exactly. And I don't think that Cameron was a particularly great Prime Minister, but I think he understood PR. He understood, you know, that you've got to get a message across. And May has this very stubborn, inward-looking strategy which doesn't suit a modern-day Prime Minister.
No, and under Cameron, the Tories distinctly stood for something. There was a feeling of what it was they were about.
Absolutely, but I think a lot of Tories disagreed with what Cameron wanted.
Yes.
And there is a means of returning to the kind of the truisms that of Thatcher, the facts of life are conservative. I think there is the potential for, say, a Boris to plough the centre ground of British politics while still harking back to Thatcher and to the classical liberal values of conservative politics.
But going back to Ruth Davidson, I don't think she meant by manning up bringing Boris in as leader, did she?
Not at all, no. I don't think that's the case at all. I think she was just talking as a currently popular leader of the Scottish Tories to a Conservative conference hall.
But also pointing out that at the moment they're in a strong position in that they are elected, they've got some time before another election needs to be called, and they should stand up and govern rather than navel gaze and fight amongst themselves.
Yeah, I mean, the big question is, would a leadership election open up a Pandora's box?
Yes, indeed.
And May took a gamble with the general election. Now, is the Tory party prepared to take a gamble and open up that Pandora's box with untold consequences? Personally, I think they should. What about you?
Well, it seems a time at which it might be sensible to think about the leadership. I don't believe that she could be someone who goes into the next election as leader.
Well, you say that, but then, you know, the Times YouGov poll from just 10 days ago, admittedly before the Theresa May speech, was saying, you know, who would make the best Prime Minister. This is Times YouGov. Theresa May was out in front with 37%, Jeremy Corbyn with 29%, and second place was not sure, 33%. So maybe, yes, she's pretty awful at the moment. She's got time to improve. Maybe she would be good enough. The problem is not that, is it? The problem is, how do the Conservative Party reshape their strategy and their appearance to get rid of the current zeitgeist in the UK, which is, you know, we love Jeremy Corbyn.
If that is the zeitgeist, it's still something I find hard to completely believe in. I know parts of Twitter say that Corbyn is a powerful person, but he never seems to me to be loved by most of the populace that I come across.
Yeah, same here, but maybe we don't mix in those kind of circles.
No,
I don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The whole situation is fairly ghastly. Navel-gazing. As a Tory, you feel, you know, something's got to give, and at this stage, surely it's May.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, is it not worth biting the bullet? Nothing could be worse than the current state of affairs. Would you agree?
I'd agree completely. I think they need a leader who defines them again.
So, Boris?
Boris seems to be the only sensible choice, doesn't he?
David Davis, possibly?
I think probably not David Davis. I think his day is probably past.
Yeah.
And I think people will never quite forget his weird resignation from his seat, yeah, forcing a by-election in his own seat,
yeah,
over nothing at all.
I mean, Brexiters just simply wouldn't countenance the idea of a Rudd or Hammond prime ministership. No. Okay. Thank you very much for that question, John. Let's move on to the second question. Basil, do you think you could be so kind as to pass Jamie the second question?
Thank you, Basil. So the second question is from Country Squire reader Sam David from Herefordshire. Was the Catalan referendum police resistance a sign of the EU's keenness to impose itself using violence and fear?
I don't believe that for one minute. Not wishing to be rude to Sam David from Herefordshire, but that sounds very conspiracist. I don't believe the EU ordered the Guardia Civil from Huelva into Catalonia to, you know, oppress the Catalonian people as they sought to vote in a referendum. I can't believe that. I mean, the EU was shocking in that it refused to condemn the poll brutality by the Spanish police. And I think they reiterated their trust in the country's Prime Minister, Rajoy, of the Partido Popular. But they said that all fallout was an internal matter. I don't think for one minute that they instructed the police. Do you?
No, I agree with you. I think it's incredibly unlikely that this was organised by Brussels, because apart from anything else, it would imply a competence on behalf of Brussels that was able to organise such a plot. And I just don't think that exists.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's just wrong. But I mean, what an awful mess. I mean, could the Spanish government have made more mistakes? I mean, that they almost created a kind of Tiananmen Square situation for the Catalonians. They must be, you know, laughing with glee at the situation, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's been appallingly badly handled. I can't understand why they didn't just allow the referendum to take place and then say that they don't respect the result of the referendum.
Some of the stuff they were doing was ridiculous. You know, they were sort of taking the names of anyone participating in the vote and confiscating documents. They said that anyone in possession of the keys or entrance codes to a polling booth could be considered a collaborator to crimes of disobedience, misuse of office and misappropriation of funds. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Completely and utterly ridiculous. Just fueling fire for the Catalonians, who obviously have sought independence for quite some time and who are, you know, a wealthy area compared to the rest of Spain and probably quite capable of being independent if they could somehow manage to get access to the, you know, EU markets. I think 2/3 of their exports go out to the EU, and obviously they'd have to get recognised by bodies like the UN, which seems highly unlikely considering Spain's position.
Yeah, absolutely. But it also highlights, doesn't it, how close to that strange fascistic state Spain still is.
Yeah, I don't buy that particularly. I think that Spain's moved on considerably since the Franco era. But of course, you know, the Spanish government's behaviour will be compared to the repression of the sort of Franco era. And it will only serve to drive more Catalans towards independence. Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, we had an article on the magazine this week which was saying that there's a very fine line between the Franco era and the current Spanish government. Again, I don't buy that.
Right.
But unfortunate echoes, no question.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, but do you think they deserve their independence?
Well, I'm not sure that independence is deserved so much as taken by people who have all of the necessary qualities for independence.
Yeah. I mean, in Spain, the Catalonians are seen as sort of very similar to the Scots in some ways. They're seen as, without wishing to be impolite to the Scots, I'm just stating fact, they're seen as the kind of the tight people, the ones who look after their money really carefully. And right now there's quite a lot of hatred between the Catalonians after what's happened and the rest of the Spanish. When the Guardia Civil officers were actually dispatched to Catalonia, they were draped in Spanish flags and cheered on by locals with cries of "Go for them,"
no,
which is not something you could imagine happening over here.
No. Really.
So there's high temperatures over there. Generally speaking, in the past anyway, there's been a lot of love between the Catalonians and the rest of the Spanish.
Right. It's interesting as well, isn't it? Because it highlights the EU's role in all of this. It may not be behind the problems that is being faced, but by the same token, we're constantly being told that the EU is a great peacemaker that holds together all of its members in a state of peace and harmony. And yet when something like this happens, they have no real answer to it, do they?
Well, they do, because they're opportunists. And the guy Verhofstadt, the dreadful Belgian fellow, he tweeted on Wednesday. Sorry, he didn't tweet. He did tweet, but he also made a speech on Wednesday. He said, there's a solution for the situation in Catalonia. Reform Spain into a federal state in a federal Europe. Pure opportunism.
Pure opportunism. And also hard to see how that solves anything.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, a complete mess. And the biggest crisis that Spain has faced since Franco.
Yes.
Which is not good. Do you want to hear a joke about a Catalan?
Yeah, why not?
Right, okay. So there's a Catalan, and on his deathbed, he whispers, Monsi, Monsi, where are you, my dear wife? She replies, here I am, my husband, next to you. And my son, Josep, where is he? Here I am, father, I'm next to you. And my daughter, Mercy, where is she? Here I am, father, I'm next to you. And my son, Jaime, where is he? Here I am, father, next to you. Well then, why the hell is the light in the kitchen on? That's the sort of Spanish attitude towards the Catalans. But there's also the ramifications for Scotland. If Catalonia is allowed independence, then it sets precedent. And one would think that the whole Scottish issue would gather steam, no?
Possibly, although the Scottish issue, I think, has been largely dealt with by their last independence referendum. I think that the desire for independence is, if anything, dropping in Scotland amongst the general population. Whereas it's never happened in Catalonia. There's never been anything to lance the boil.
Yeah. I mean, from a purely economic basis, I think Barcelona is what, the fifth busiest port in Europe, and tourism industry into Catalonia is massive. So if you compare that as a sort of economic possible to Scotland, Scotland doesn't really stand up.
No.
Thank you very much for that question, Sam David from Herefordshire. I hope we've answered that for you. Okay, so that's two questions down and just one to go. Basil, if you could pass me the final question, that would be jolly kind of you. Thanks, Basil. So the final question is from Georgina Wild. Pretentious, overpriced, and full of townies. James Dellingpole, who else, says we would all be better off at Lidl or Aldi than a farm shop. Is he right?
Much as I love James Dellingpole, I think he's being a little bit ungenerous towards the farming community here, because farm shops have been one way in which farmers have had the opportunity to diversify and to bring in new income streams. And of course, they're going to be a very different market to the large discounters like Lidl and Aldi. But that's not to say that they are without a place in the overall scheme of shopping, is it?
To give James some credit, I've got the article here. He says in his article, they keep a roof over the heads of hard-pressed farmers, labourers in the fields, cattle supplied with feed, and boost the rural economy. So you wander desperately around, every product exquisitely displayed in wicker baskets or with gingham trimmings, labelled with mouth-watering descriptions in illuminated script, in search of something you can afford to buy without losing face. He's quite tough on them. He sort of starts out by saying that some years ago there was a farm shop in Worcestershire, which he loved to visit, run by a Mr. and Mrs. Orchard. And it operated out of a tiny wooden hut next to the barns where they milked their herd of Guernseys. Then he goes on to say, beyond were the fields where they grew their carrots, cabbages, potatoes, turnips, whatever was in season, and all of them sold at such stupidly low prices that my jaw used to drop every time I got the bill. which of course Mr. Orchard would tot up in his head from a handwritten list. The Orchards could afford to do this because by selling direct to the consumer they were cutting out the middlemen and avoiding those iniquitous deals that supermarket buyers tend to impose on farmers. It was a win-win situation for buyer and seller. And he goes on just to say that it's basically they're full of townies and the prices are crazy and they just seem a complete rip-off. And you're better off picking up most of the stuff in there from Lidl or Aldi, which tends to... Do you go to Aldi?
It's a false comparison though, isn't it? Because nobody who goes to a farm shop is doing it because they think it might be the same as going to Lidl or Aldi. Nobody's doing it on the basis of finding something very cheap to feed themselves for the week. They're doing it because it's an enjoyable experience. It's a more exciting way of shopping. And it's a day out rather than simply going to pick up things that are needed, isn't it?
Well, we're here. We're spoilt in the middle of the countryside because we're surrounded by some really impressive farm shops. But let's be honest, why do we go to those farm shops?
Well, because there's really good things to be bought there. And you feel good buying them.
Yeah. I mean, I get my socks there, for example. There are nice coffee places you can pop into by the car park and have, you know, coffee and chips.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of imported French stuff in there, cheeses and sauces and what have you. And the kind of stuff you don't get in Lidl and Aldi, the kind of sausages and bacon that really is just absolutely delicious. Yeah,
absolutely.
But I can see, I still get where James is coming from, that there has been a big change. Now, I mean, if you're a local in one of the villages where these farm shops that we know are based, would you be shopping there?
Probably not, because, as I say, it's not the sort of thing that you'd go for your weekly shop to do, is it?
No.
It's more a treat.
Yeah, I mean, he's saying that it reminds him of wandering into one of those high-end Notting Hill boutiques looking for a present for my wife. You know, it's how much? That sort of thing. Everything seems to cost twice what you'd pay in a supermarket, but you feel horribly under pressure to make a purchase. Something, anything, because farm shops are a good thing, aren't they? I don't think, I mean, that's not my experience. The farm shops that I go to are massive great warehouses type places.
Yeah.
And the small little farm shops, I don't see many of around. Maybe it's just where James lives, I don't know.
Yeah.
But have you tested the produce in Lidl and Aldi or not recently?
I have tested produce in Lidl and Aldi.
You're a waitress man, are you not?
I tend to shop wherever's closest to me.
Very good, yeah. And there is some good sort of ice cream from Italy and so forth in Lidl, so I understand.
Apparently so.
what else is there that in there that make you particularly go? Is it just because of the prices, or have they got good sort of pano raisin, or what is it that makes you go to those places?
To be honest, I find the whole supermarket shopping quite depressing in itself, and any of them are as unappealing as each other. Whereas when I go to a farm shop, I feel slightly uplifted. There's something pleasant about it.
Yeah. I mean, if the farm shop is the main source of income for that particular farmer, there is a kind of obligation, is there not, to pop in and grab something or other. But when you know that the owner of the farm shop is a multi-millionaire, there's less obligation?
I suppose.
We must support our British farmers. So if we can't support our British farmers through supermarkets as much, isn't it our obligation as British subjects to pop into these farm shops and support directly this sort of artisanal produce?
I think it's also something that people want to do. I mean, as far as I can see, farm shops are usually well supplied with clientele who are quite happy to be there.
Yeah. I'm all for sort of supporting organic herd and pigs in farm shops, but I'm also all for supporting brilliant Italian ice cream producers in Lidl, no?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so free market. But I totally understand where James is coming from, whereas you don't, yeah?
I'm unsure as to whether he's simply being a little bit tight in terms of his reaction.
I mean, he's saying, when I dare venture into a farm shop now, I come away with the same feeling I get after an unsuccessful day at the races or a bad night at the casino. The one that says, "You mug, they saw you coming." I don't get that feeling. Do you?
No, I don't get that feeling either.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we should celebrate all farm shops, which and especially those ones who've kept farms afloat by opening the shop. All the cheese makers, the sausage makers, and so forth. And James, you're just plain wrong. Well, that brings us to the end of our Country Squire magazine podcast. Jamie and I would like to thank you for listening. And please do remember to use our Twitter accounts for feedback. If you have a question for one of the upcoming episodes, then please do let us know. Special thanks this week go to our colleagues John Alexander and Nai Yi, who kept the magazine running these last few weeks while I took a trip out to southwest France to get a nice tan and Jamie had a rest before our upcoming launches of the magazine in the US and India. We could not have expected a year ago when we launched that the magazine would be such a success. Our articles are plastered over some impressive channels like Conservative Home, and we have been referenced regularly in the national press. Looking back, we owe our success to having listened respectfully to the very best advice, and then having gone away and done the exact opposite. We particularly thank our writers, who have made my job as editor easy. They say you should never trust a tanned editor, but really the writer's submissions have almost always been word perfect and beautifully scribed. So thanks to them. And thanks to you, Jamie, of course, for your excellent ongoing legal advice. The trouble with the legal profession is that 98% of its members give the rest a bad name. Thanks for being part of the 2%, my friend. You can contact us through the Country Squire magazine website or on Facebook or Twitter or by email at editor@countrysquiremagazine.co.uk. We really look forward to hearing from you, however inane or insane your message might be.
Many thanks for listening. Thank you, Basil, for your assistance. Also, thanks, Dom, for the banter. I look forward to the next podcast, which we'll try and do every few weeks and publish on the magazine.
So that's bye from me.
And that's toodle-pip from me. Till we meet again.
Goodbye.